All right, we're going to start with 2 minutes of meditation, and then I'm going to lead you guys in a prayer. Let's see what. Please repeat after me. Spirit,
we
invite you here tonight.
We invite you here tonight
to guide us and to direct us.
To guide us and direct us.
Please set aside.
Please set aside
that within each of us.
That within each of us.
That blocks us from the truth.
That blocks us from the truth.
Please set aside.
Please set aside
what we think this meeting will look like.
What we think this meeting will look like.
What we think this weekend will look like.
What we think this weekend will look like.
So we can have an open mind.
So we can have an open mind.
And a new experience.
And a new experience.
Help us see the truth.
Help us see the truth.
Amen.
Amen.
I'd like each of you to consider that you had no choice in being here this weekend. That a power and a God of our limited understanding that we cannot define or comprehend has brought you here as part of your path. I don't know what direction your path is going to go after this weekend. And like I said from the outset, I have no idea what each of you needs. But my third step compels me to testify. God, please take away my difficulties so victory over them shall bear witness to those that I will help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. That compels me to bear witness to his power in my life. And that's my responsibility this weekend. What effect that produces in your life, I have no idea. I want to read something. Typically when I start, I'm going to read something and we're going to see where it goes. This is called Opportunity. A green bird darting in the night. Will you be able to see it? Will you be able to catch it? Cling to spirit like a shadow. Move without a shadow. Times of oppression and adversity like addiction and early recovery cannot last forever. How is the transition made to new and better situations? In the midst of great difficulty, a tiny opportunity will open. If only by chance. You might be sharp enough to discern it. We say that you must be sharp enough to discern it, quick enough to catch it, and determined enough to do something with it. If you let it pass, you will be filled with regrets. Stick to spirit like a shadow. Wherever it goes, you go. As soon as it throws something your way, catch it by sheer reflex. It is like the bird. If you try to catch it, you will miss. If you're always with it, moving at its speed, as much a part of it as its own shadow, then it's easy to seize it. When you act, however, you in turn must have no shadow. In other words, what you do must leave no messiness, no leftover consequences, nothing that will haunt you later. That is one of the ways in which you avoid creating more bad situations for yourself. Your every movement is traceless. And I think this applies to early recovery. I'm reading this tonight because I see a lot of people in early recovery. You have to win now. This is life and death. It's one of the questions I would invite you to consider is, do you believe this is life and death? I loved what Mike was talking about. You know, there's a cake here. In my whole life, I've always wanted the cake to myself, and I guarded it, and I did it whatever I could to have the entire cake. I wanted the best crack. I wanted the best dope. I drank at high-end bars. I wanted strong drinks. And for whatever reason, that mentality followed me into the rooms. So I went to the guys that had the best recovery, in my opinion. Do you know what attracted me to them in the beginning? Like, they drove nice cars, and then they carried the message to me in the beginning. They wore nice clothes, drove nice cars, they smelled good, they looked good. This was the linchpin. They would stand outside in front of this church and they laughed. They laughed. That was really important for me in early recovery. They taught me about the meeting before the meeting, and the meeting after the meeting. So I was talking to a buddy today. He was telling me he's going to a meeting every night of the week. I said, why? I was never taught meeting-based sobriety. I was also taught the third tradition, which says that anytime two alcoholics or two addicts sit down, they can call themselves an AA group. That means every time I sit down to take someone through the 12 steps and go through this book, that is a meeting. I go to my home group. If you have a family, your family will fall apart if you say yes to every AA service commitment and every CA service commitment. There's this belief system that this destroys families that you never say no to a commitment. I've turned down commitments before. I've turned down engagements before. So just be mindful of that, because that did play a role in ultimately my marriage falling apart. I want to read something. Now look, in early recovery, I would have come out here and I would have introduced myself as a recovered addict. I don't do that anymore. You immediately separate the room when you do that. I don't know why we do it. I used to do it because I thought it sounded cool. I wanted to be different. That's not like from this man and another man named Ralph. They've taught me a very valuable lesson in including everybody. Not having everyone's on their own path. And it's really important for us to include people, because if we don't, we could be spoiling an opportunity to carry the message at a later time. Alright? Have I recovered? Absolutely. From a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Do I believe that people that introduce themselves as recovering are wrong? No, because I wish sometimes they would say, because I understand what they mean by that. I think they mean that they're always going to be recovering from the spiritual malady, the internal brokenness that everyone in this room has suffered from and continues to suffer from on some level. As you keep peeling layers of the onion, there's a healing it's an ongoing healing that will happen for us. But I have recovered from the mental and the physical aspects of this illness. You'll never hear me call it a disease. Big Book doesn't call it a disease. It calls it an illness of this sort, and that's what I believe it to be, an illness. And so I want everybody to feel a part of. I think it's really important. So as we're talking about this, the circle, I'm gonna give you guys a compass. So when I sponsor guys, at least once a month, we're going to sit down and do this exercise called location. I locate them using the circle and the triangle, using AA's three legacies: recovery, unity, and service. So I believe that as alcoholics and addicts, we suffer from three severe problems. The first, the inability to think straight and lack of proportion. The Big Book's definition of insanity, which is the best definition of insanity that I've ever heard. that lack of proportion and inability to think straight has followed me into other areas of my life, not just alcohol and drugs. When you work the first 11 steps, specifically the first 11 steps, you will recover. Right? We're given back our sanity in the 10th step. We actually turn our will over in the third step, and then we can practice, you know, our will along certain lines in the 10th step. If you work the first 11 steps and stay active, specifically in 9, 10, and 11, because it's going to take a minute, because it says a long period of reconstruction lies ahead for us and making amends, you will have much more proportion in your life, and you'll think straight much more often than you did prior to that process. Again, but you'll, if you continue to revisit the process, you will peel layer after layer after layer, and you will see more truth, and you'll uncover more lies. That's the recovery piece of those three legacies, in my opinion. Now, another problem we have is we walk through the doors and we don't feel like we've come home. We walk through the doors and we experience a sense of separation. We walk through the doors and it's like we're all a herd, and some of us stick together in the middle of the herd, but then we've got these people that are on the outside. And, you know, my buddy Mr. Crack and Mike's buddy Heron, they're sitting on the outside waiting to pick us off. So that tells me when I walk in, I have to experience some unity. The unity will pull me to the middle. And the way I have found most effective to create that unity is get a home group. Go to group conscience on a regular basis. Give yourself a job in that group if you don't have an open service commitment. What I mean by that, I suggest to the guys I sponsor, they get to the meeting at least 30 minutes before the meeting, and their job for that night is to talk to as many people as they can, specifically new people. Just make them feel welcome. That's your job. And then find those 3 to 5 closed-mouth friends that you can have transparent dialogue with about your darkness. Because everybody here has a dark passenger. Who watches Dexter? Dexter? Dexter, dark passenger. Everybody sitting in this room tonight, Mike and I are not excluded, has a dark passenger traveling with them. Who knows about your dark passenger? That will take unity to a whole new level. Okay, so we carry our mind through the recovery process, our body into the fellowship, and discover the unity and the fellowship we crave. And how do we feed our spirit? Now, I believe setting up meetings and cleaning up after meetings and taking people to meetings is a service that's attached to unity. Because without those services, we would not stay unified. Now, the only service that I discuss with sponsees, and people will debate with me, is fine. There's no judgment. Okay? I'm just telling you the way I was taught. Service is work and self-sacrifice for others to work the 12 steps. So when you go through the steps in your first pass through the steps and subsequent passes, you're not doing the work. You're doing the prep work. The real work's like they say in the foreword of the second edition. One addict working with another, one alcoholic working with another is vital for permanent recovery. Permanent. You guys know what the word permanent means? It doesn't mean one day at a time. I've learned how to live my life a day at a time, but I was guaranteed if I followed the process outlined in this book that I would have permanent recovery. That's a much more attractive promise. Right, who wants to stay sober one miserable day at a time? White knuckling it, grinding those teeth. All right, so service. I feed the spirit, and I grow spiritually more when I watch someone else grow spiritually. And I'm going to tell you why. So I have been blessed over these 10 and a half years where I've sponsored quite a few men that have stayed sober for a great length of time. Not of my doing. But here's the deal. Like, I saw them on day one, and I see them now, and there's no explanation for the transformation other than the regenerative power of God. So I have these men that I see, and every time I see some of them, my awareness is drawn to God, is drawn to power, is drawn to this process. And then it's drawn to a specific line on page 568 in our big book, if you have a fourth edition. 568 is one of the most overlooked paragraphs, and it's very short. It says, most of us believe that the essence, and you guys understand that the word essence is a central point, it's a very important aspect of whatever you're talking about. The essence of a spiritual experience is simply the awareness of a power greater than myself. I translate that into, I need to think about his God as often as possible. That's what sponsorship will do. Sponsorship has a residual effect for me. And it's how I grow more spiritually when I'm in that transaction or that experience of carrying this message to this individual and then watch those lights come on. That's the good dope, ladies and gentlemen. That's an experience you don't want to miss. That's what this whole thing is about. We have 12 steps, 12 traditions, 12 concepts. They culminate into one thing, carrying the message to the alcoholic or addict who still suffers. That is it. If anyone's told you anything else, you've been misinformed. Okay. Let's turn to the doctor's opinion real quick. I'm in the fourth edition. Page XXVI, Roman numeral 16. I'm going to share with you some of the ways I take people through the book. Now, we don't have enough time to cover everything, so this is where I've been led tonight. I'm reading the paragraph. It says the doctor's theory. You guys see where I'm at?
Yeah.
Okay.
The
XXVI, 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 I'm going to read it. The doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol and drugs interests us. As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may of course mean little, but as ex-problem drinkers and ex-drug users, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. The allergy explains many things for which I could not otherwise account for. And so I'm sure everyone in this room, as a result of their addiction, most of us, I can't speak for everyone, but I bet everybody in here has done something horrific to someone you care about as a result of your addiction, if you're an alcoholic or an addict, especially if you fit the description that's in this big book. And so for years, I was told I had a broken moral compass. I was told that I could not make choices, that I was not empowered. And then some people just said, I was a piece of shit. And then I started to tell myself that I was a piece of shit, that I was worthless, that I was a bad human, all the negative self-talk that occurs. And so the vicious cycle would build on itself because we begin to feel emotions and we begin to experience regret, shame, and guilt once we come into the rooms and we get the further away we get from that last drink or drug, that stuff starts to come to the surface. And it has to be dealt with. And the 12-step process can deal with it. Some of us don't ever get that far. So, there was an experience I had. I was in Las Vegas. This was 2005. I'd been up the whole time I was there. I was there 6 or 7 days. And, engaging in a lot of alcohol consumption and all kinds of drugs and smoking a lot of crack. Missed a couple flights. I flew to Atlanta, Georgia. The craving was still on me. It was still active, right? I still wanted more. That thing we break out in, the phenomenon of craving, right? It's, I want more. But for the cocaine addict, it's all in your head, in your mind. We don't actually have a physical craving in our body for more cocaine. My mind transforms. The mind is an organ in the body, so there's the abnormal physical reaction. And so I'm in the midst of the craving. The fire's been activated. It's another way I describe the physical craving. A fire lights up inside of me, and it burns for as long as it wants to, and it goes out on its own. And another one that I love to use is the monster wakes up, and the monster goes back to sleep when the monster goes to sleep. See, Tarek's not involved in anything at that point, right? At some point between the second rock and the fifth rock, Tarek's removed from the equation, and the crack smoke in the crack, all right? And drinking the drink. So I get back to my house with my girlfriend, and I'm trying to get together as much money as I can to go back down to the hood to get some more. My mom, who hasn't seen me in I don't know how long, comes to the house, and she's trying to stop the monster from leaving the house. And so I called my mom the C word, I called her the B word. And I picked up a Dirt Devil vacuum cleaner, a handheld one, and I threw it at her head as hard as I could. Now, that experience horrified my mom. She didn't know who she was looking at. And for years, the amount of shame and guilt I carried with that experience, it was hard for me at times to look at my mom in the eye after what I had done. And then a man sat me down. And we were in the doctor's opinion. And he read this line. It explains many things for which we could not otherwise account. Why did I pawn all that stuff? Why did I lie and steal? Why did I disappear for days on end with other people's money? I'm a piece of shit. But no, I'm not. It hit me when I read this. Holy shit. Once I start, all bets are off. I'm literally not responsible for the things that happen, but I am responsible for the things that happen. So it's a both and. Let me explain this. So when I understood the loss of power once I start, that I'm stripped, in whatever path, I'm compelled by another force, driven, forcibly undergoing courses of action that I don't want to do, which is powerlessness. Everything and all those people I harmed, I couldn't have done any different. See, I only experience guilt and shame and remorse and regret when I look at the past and I think I could have done different. So I have shame and guilt. When I woke up that I could not have done any different, I got free. I wasn't a piece of shit anymore. I didn't have a broken moral compass. But the man who taught it to me this way also said, you are responsible, though, because you have to go make these things what we call nine-step amends, and you can't talk about any of this in your nine-step amends. Nobody that you harm wants to know that you lost power, choice, and control and activated the fire inside of you and woke up the monster. They don't care. All they want to know is that you regret what you did and you're willing to do anything you can to make it right. That's it. So when I struggle sponsoring people that have a tremendous amount of guilt, I try to talk. This is how I teach the physical craving. You could not have done any different. Otherwise, you would have done different. Loss of power. Okay?
Put all of everything aside, I'm kind of grateful I have my guilt and my shame. You know, it's like a touchstone for me. Like, regardless of what all the psychotherapists have been jumping all over my case to get rid of guilt and shame, I'm kind of appreciative of it because it makes me human again. And I'm happy to feel guilty about those things.
Okay.
Like, if I didn't feel guilty and shameful about those things, there would be something serious fucking wrong with me because I did a lot of shit, right? So, yes, it may be due to phenomenal craving, no doubt. You're 100% right, but at some level, you know, I'm very grateful today to be able to have guilt and shame because it's a blessing because now I can go out and do the right thing.
So it puts you at a place. So, perfect. What it does is that it puts you at a place in your life, right? And I developed something a couple of years called Step Zero. And Step Zero is about being at that place where you are awake to the fact that something's wrong here. But a lot of times what we do with Step Zero, we don't do nothing about it. We well aware of something's wrong, but we don't take the next step, which is the first step, right? So let me read something to you. I developed this for a workshop in Holland. Step Zero, do you have a problem in the realization of truth? Are you in or out? Literally speaking, step one is the first step of the 12-step process as outlined in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. But realistically thinking or speaking, a breakthrough must occur for the individual suffering from untreated alcoholism and or untreated drug addiction. Living a life of torment and despair. This has been identified as step zero. This is some Mike D shit, okay? The beginning of the end. We have the newcomer and the umpteenther, all in need of acknowledgement that something is wrong. And that's why we stay stuck for so long. I get the red flags, but I won't bow. They may or may not have brought into the idea or theory that they have a problem. Opening up to step zero. They become inquisitive because things, life isn't working out. I'm not going to read all of these, I'm just going to read some. The idea that getting high as a way of life renders them helpless. Can't create change because of the mindset and nature of the disease or the illness, which they know nothing about. So it holds them hostage. Until I got to the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and until I got to this process, and somebody spoon-fed me the information, I didn't know nothing about an allergy, a phenomenal craving that automatically my body takes over, and I can forget. With all the wishes in the world, I'm not going to stop. I didn't know nothing about an obsession of the mind, that I was really insane, because really what I was doing was committing suicide on a daily basis. I just couldn't die. So the information in this book, I'm being held hostage because I don't have what's needed in order for me to do what's needed to be done in my life. Clearly, as to the severity of the dilemma they are in, blocked from reality by ego, the sense of self and self-power. What is ego? Edging God out. Denial. Refusal to admit the truth. Stubbornness. Justifiably unyielding. Society's imposed values to living life. Man is all powerful. I can do this. I can fix it. I'm a man. Man is all knowing. I can work it out. I'm a man. Capable of being like other people. I tried to be like my brothers forever. Crossed the line at 17. I would never be like them. Abnormal. Resistant to change. Gets comfortable in the uncomfortability because they know it and seemingly the outcome. So you stay where you're at because you have an idea that, okay, this will happen, but you never entertain the idea that, you know, next time I take one, it could kill me. I never entertain that. Buying into step zero, hit bottom. To push off from step zero to step one, stay awake. Once you wake up, stay awake. Something's wrong here. I need help. So you reach your hand out. Internal conscious awareness that you are at step zero and need help. Step zero is like calling the operator or tuning into your GPS to get help and directions. Do we do that? No. We just stay stuck. When all around us, and a lot of us, we've attended, if it wasn't 12-step rooms, some type of assembly that was proactive in helping me change my life, but I wasn't willing. I didn't listen. That's just a little bit of this step zero that I created as a result of knowing that before step one, there has to be a willingness, right, to take the next step. And until I'm thoroughly convinced, and I'm going to let T chime back in here for a minute, but until I'm totally convinced that I'm at zero and there's no place else for me to go, I'm going to keep trying to do what I've been doing forever. And I stay on the merry-go-round. I stay on it.
You know, once I saw being stripped of power, choice, and control in the physical craving, and we talk about acceptance all the time. One of the myths is acceptance is not the answer. Because when things are acceptable, I tend not to do anything. Mm-hmm. When things become unacceptable, I become willing to take a new course of action. You know, what happened with my mom finally became unacceptable, and it was a launching pad that I needed. So it's in conjunction. You know, as I'm reflecting back, it wasn't like once I woke up to the physical craving, there were other things, other requirements that had to take place. Nine-step amends was one of them. Sitting down, looking at these people eye to eye. You know, I'll talk about this when I get to amends, but it took me 8.5 years to approach 230 people in institutions. And I've approached, there's not a person on this planet that I'm consciously aware of that I own amends to. Why do I talk about this? Because it's possible. Why don't we, I don't know about you guys here in Canada, but we don't have a lot of discussion topics where the topic's making nine-step amends. You know why? Because very few people make anything outside their immediate family and a few maybe friends around that. Now, granted, those are emotionally very difficult to make, but the reality is I was much more fearful when I had to track down someone I hadn't seen in 10 years. Because I really had no idea how that one was. I knew when I went to my family, they weren't going to spit in my face and tell me to get the hell out. It was going to be a lot of tears and a lot of emotion. So it's not, you know, you wake up to this concept and then you see it in your experience and you wake up again and then you wake up again. And it's just, it's the traction and the momentum. But like Mike said, you know, step zero is the wonderfully horrific time between the last drug and the last drink and the time I give myself to the process and say, okay, I'm going to live life on a spiritual basis because I don't have any other choice. But see, what happens to us is we have diet addict death or alcoholic death, live life on a spiritual basis, or just go to meetings. Or just go to treatment. Go live with my parents. Fix everything with the wife. Bring the kids back home. Once we burn every alternative to the ground and we're left with two alternatives, we think there's a choice, but if you want to live and you want to breathe, there's really no choice. It's a choice we make from a place of no choice. And as we keep going through this doctor's opinion, I want to talk about another way I show someone that I'm sponsoring how to see if they're physically powerless. It says on the bottom of the, if you turn the page, XXIX, at the very bottom, it says, I do not hold with those who believe that alcoholism and drug addiction are entirely problems of mental control. I've had many men who had, for example, worked a period of months on some problem or business deal, which was to be settled on a certain date in their favor, favorably to them. They took a drink or a drug a day or so prior to the date, then the monster woke up, the fire was activated, the phenomenon of craving at once became more paramount, more important than anything else, all other interests, so that the important appointment, like getting to work sober, making the kids' birthday parties, making the holiday family events, being where I said I was going to be, all these things are examples, were not met. I was not drinking or using drugs to escape, specifically smoking crack, but I was drinking and or using to overcome a craving beyond my mental control. So I go back into the experience of the men I sponsor, and I'm looking for all these important engagements that were missed over and over and over until they can clearly see once they start, all bets are off. Once I start, I cannot control the amount. That's physically, that's what we're looking at. Okay? Turn back a page. You want to do this?
What's that?
Men and women drink essentially?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I had turned to that because there's a... this is a piece that helps me when I'm working with people for them to differentiate whether they're alcoholic or addict. The majority of people in the rooms of recovery are either alcoholic or addict. There are some that are both, but very few. And on page XXVI, this is the third edition, though. I don't know what it is in the fourth edition.
It is XXVIII in the fourth edition.
This is the third edition that still has the circle and triangle on the title page, so you know it's old. They don't even put it in the big book no more. But it says, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. So I simply ask them, do you like the effect produced by alcohol? And have you ever had the power to put alcohol down and leave it down? And the majority of the time, sometimes not, they're either identified with the fact of they've never had the power to put alcohol down and leave it down. They'll start using other mind-altering substances, eventually put that down and pick up alcohol again. Or they've been able to put alcohol down, and whatever what it is that they put alcohol down for, they're able to leave alcohol down, and they use that continuously. That's what takes them to their bottom. So what it did for me, as a result of this being done with me, it helped me to identify whether I'm alcoholic or I'm addict or alcoholic addict. And what I've found over the years, as a result of working with people and as a result of talking with people, there's a lot of addicts that hide out in Alcoholics Anonymous. There ain't no more addict than the man in the moon. But because of a number of reasons, they will frequent that fellowship, but they sit in those meetings and they're dying because they can't identify with the real alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is for alcoholics. That's for them guys that see stuff on the walls and, you know, wear straight jackets and put in padded cells. And when they go in treatment, they go in treatment to detox off alcohol with antabuse or whatever they're using now. I never went into treatment for alcohol. All the treatment programs I went into, this was for drugs, and specifically heroin. I never stole for alcohol. I didn't rob my mama for alcohol. I robbed her for a shot of dope. I never sat in a jail cell for alcohol. I never sold my soul for alcohol. At the age of 16, when I met Heron, alcohol went on the back burner. I could care less about a drink. In my second piece of work, I became thoroughly convinced when I sat down with Joe. When he talked about alcohol, I identified on the same level with Heron, my experience with Heron. Thus, what happened for me back in 1988, I was able to find my tribe. I was able to find like-minded people in Cocaine Anonymous. Cocaine Anonymous is about cocaine and all other mind-altering substances. So we don't care what you use. Why? Because we use the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. We use the process outlined in this book. And that process can be used for alcoholic or addict. So this was important, pertinent for me to begin to solidify my foundation. What's my foundation? Step one. My foundation is step one. That's what's kept me here for 30-something years. The fact that I am at it, and first step deals with allergy, mind, body, obsession, mind, and spiritual malady. We'll talk about malady, the word malady, later, maybe. I might talk about it, I might not. But the book calls it a spiritual malady, a spiritual sickness, illness. As a result of that, identifying and being crystal clear. For me, it was impressed upon me to be crystal clear. When I was in the street, I didn't hang out with crackheads. I didn't hang out with alcoholics and winos. I hung out with dope fiends. I hung out with heroin addicts. My truth is that when you come to find us, you need to find your people. Because you're going to find somebody that talks what? The language of the heart, dealing with what you use. There, one crackhead can understand another crackhead like nobody else can. An alcoholic can understand another alcoholic like nobody else can. God has gifted me that I work with anybody on a number of subjects. It's because I've been doing it for so long. But we help each other. Doctors, psychiatrists, therapists, they're an extension of what we do. There's another book that says, physician, heal thyself. We heal each other. The magic is with me sitting down with you. Across the table, eyeball to eyeball, seeing the light bulb come on. And if the light bulb don't come on, I sit there with you until it comes on, as long as you're willing to sit there. And if you're not willing to sit there no more, then I let you go. But as long as you're willing to sit there, I sit there with you. I've had guys, I've had the sponsor that I had to giving them 12-step tapes to do the work because they can't read and they can't write. I got one guy I'm working with now in Vegas is very slow. So we take like two lines at a time. That's it. But it's the magic of what we do, and it's the foundation that needs to happen for an individual. What I stand on, my step one experience is what I stand on. I'm an addict. I will always have the allergy. I will always have the obsession. My knowingness knows if I pick up tonight, I will probably pick up from where I left off 30 years ago. Why? Because I'm a mad dog. I love heroin. I want the full effect of what heroin does. So I'm going to look for the dope man with the best bag of dope. You with me? Mm-hmm. So it's of crucial importance, and that helps so much with working with others. Men and women use, or men and women drink, essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. I got to a certain point in my using where I couldn't stand the smell of alcohol. Couldn't stand it. And can't stand it today. So that was crucial for me. Another piece that I want to just introduce right quick, and it's in my workbook. A couple of you guys got it. It's a piece in my workbook called Surrender versus Compliance. And it's by Harry Tebow. It's one of a series of papers that he wrote down through the years for Alcoholics Anonymous. And I tweaked it somewhat to put it in my workbook. And it's about the individual that comes to see us that becomes compliant with what we ask them to do. But internally, they never surrender. And sooner or later, it catches up with them, and they do what? They do what? No. They do what? Somebody said it. Use. Exactly. Because this is about total surrender. There's a part of me that's defiant. I ain't doing what you tell me to do no matter what. Anybody like that? I was like that for 20-something years. I ain't doing it. Hit me in the head. I ain't doing it. But in order for you to recover, that part of you has to come under submission. And I'm not going to go in length about that piece, but it's in the workbook. Very powerful piece. When I read it, it blew me away. It explained to me what was wrong with me for all them years from that first treatment program at the age of 19 to the last one at the age of 37. There's a part of me that knew I had the answer to my drug addiction and the way I live life. And that sooner or later I would work it out. And I lost that at 17. I crossed the line at 17. I'd never have power, choice, and control over my drinking or my using or my life. I had given that up at the age of 17. Go ahead, Jake.
Do I believe an alcoholic can sponsor a drug addict successfully? Absolutely. Do I believe a heroin addict can sponsor a cocaine addict? Absolutely. I've seen it done. I've done it myself. I'm going to tell you all a story that really changed the way I looked at this. I do believe identification is vital. It's, you know, on page 18 in the big book, it says, because I've gone through the steps, I'm a man that's properly armed with facts about myself now. And I can generally win the entire confidence of an addict and an alcoholic, depending. Like, an alcoholic is going to take me a few hours. Heroin addict is going to take me not as long as the alcoholic, a little bit longer. Same with meth. I sit down with a crackhead, I got you in 15 minutes. All right? Because we speak the same. I speak crackhead language. You know, I don't quite get the heroin addict, folks. I don't. On some level, there's parts of that that I just don't get. Can I be effective with them? Yes. But about six years ago, a man that I sponsor who's a true blue alcoholic, no drug experience whatsoever, an old friend of mine from the other life came into the rooms. We had a lot of mutual friends. The guy comes into the rooms. He's a junkie, heroin addict. Starts working the steps with the guy I sponsor, Brandon. And they're standing outside a meeting one night, and I can't remember if he was on Subutex or Suboxone or Methadone, but he was going through withdrawal. So Brandon walks up to him and does what a sponsor does, is he rips him a new one for, you know, why are you nodding out and why are your eyes rolling back in your head and so forth, and what's going on with you? He's like, I'm going through withdrawal. And Brandon's like, yeah, I got no idea what that's like. And Nick completely shut down on them. They lost any identification they'd built up to that point. And they've had some type of verbal altercation. And the kid, you know, Nick said to him, he goes, you have no idea what it's like to be a fucking junkie. All right. A few days later, Nick makes the decision that he's going to go to his priest at church. And he's going to go see an addictionologist. So I get involved in the situation. I get on the phone with him. I have a long conversation with him. And he's like, Tarek, I really appreciate it. It sounded so much like Fred in the big book. Tarek, I really appreciate everything you guys have been trying to do for me, but I'm going to go see this addictionologist and this priest, and if that doesn't work, I'm going to come back. Just keep coming back. It kills people, right? Because you're under the assumption that you get to come back. All right? And that's what I said to Nick. And 2 weeks later, he was dead. And I learned a valuable lesson about identification. I watched it with my own eyes. Now, some people are going to say this is semantics. But it's not. When two heroin addicts and two cocaine addicts and two alcoholics sit down, the chance of success just increases. That's all. Isn't that what we're going for here? Success? I love working with cocaine addicts. That's where my heart is. I'll work with the others, but I've sponsored enough true blue alcoholics and heroin addicts where I just hand them off now. I prefer to work with cocaine addicts. There's the only morality we live by in Alcoholics Anonymous and Cocaine Anonymous. If what you're doing is working, keep doing it. That's the morality. Ask yourself over and over, how's it working for me? Let's go to page, on page 23, they make a very significant transition in our big book. So the doctor's opinion is the physical craving. They talk about this idea of our ideals being grounded in a power greater than ourselves, and they talk about the spiritual malady, restless, irritable, discontent. Bill's story is an identification exercise. That's how I use it. Highlight any time you thought like Bill, drank like Bill, did drugs like Bill drank, or you felt like Bill. And then in the second 8 pages of Bill's story, let's talk about what he did to recover, and are you willing to do everything that Bill did? That's what I do for Bill's story. 17 to 23, we're looking at the physical craving again. What happens to us when alcohol and drugs are in our body? And then on page 23, they completely switch everything. They say, Tarek, all these observations you've made about the physical craving are academic and pointless if you just never picked up the first one. And here's the most interesting thing about the first one. We do it from a state of consciousness called sobriety. So I used to take a meeting to a treatment center, and I always ask them, what's the most insane thing you've ever done that has to do with drugs and alcohol? And it's a trick question, because every single time the story has to do with being under the influence. And I tell them, no. Based on your track record with drugs and alcohol, the most insane thing you've ever done is take the first one. Why do we take the first one, setting the terrible cycle in motion? And it has to do with illusions, obsessions, delusions, and not being able to tell the difference between what's true and false. Not denial. See, the big book, the authors of the big book did not mess up when they left the word denial out. It's once in the 164. It's in Bill's story, and him and his dad are talking about the proffered temperance pledge that he took, and he denied the sphere's influence. Only time. Okay? In the first 164. Do you think that was an accident? I don't think it was. See, our family members and the people closest to us, they suffer from denial because they see the elephant in the room, and they deny the elephant's existence in the room. Us, alcoholics and addicts, we don't even know the damn elephant's in the room. Delusion. Illusion. Can't tell the difference between what's true and false. The word denial implies a choice. Deny means to reject. And so when I make a choice, would you guys agree with me that making a choice is an intellectual sorting out process? You weigh out your options and then you deny them or accept them. So I'm going to give you guys an example of no mental power. See, a lot of people can see that they lose the power after they start. Simple, right? Look at your experience. But I have seen a lot of guys I've taken through the steps struggle with the idea that they don't have a choice, stone cold sober. In that moment, I made a choice. Okay, let's talk about it. So I used to be an analyst, and I would stay up smoking crack, and I would still go to work. I'd spend a ton of money. It's Wednesday. Been up since Saturday. I finally go to sleep Tuesday night. I go into the office on Wednesday, and I'm fine. There are no thoughts about that first 20 rock off the stems yet. 10 o'clock hits, and I get this vision of a big 20 rock at the end of my stem, right? And then I start to go through this intellectual sorting out process. I don't get paid till Friday. I owe Kevin $100. I owe this guy $50. I've got to get mom something for, no, I'm not smoking crack today. And the thought goes away. I just went through an intellectual sorting out process and made a choice. Okay? A couple hours later, it comes back. This time's a little bit stronger. I engage the intellectual sorting out process, and it goes away again. Happens later on. About 3 o'clock, I probably get a text message from one of my crack dealers telling me he's got something for me, so it starts up again, right? This time, I'm able to make a choice. But see, something happens around 5 o'clock. Around 5 o'clock, I go to the parking garage to get into my car, and I drive down to this light. I can go left and go downtown, or I can go straight and go home. That intellectual sorting out process that I had access to all day is unavailable to me at the fucking traffic light. And I go downtown. So I'm going to tell you exactly where this is in the big book and how it explains it. Page 24. That's one place, is the blank spot. That's on 42, I'm on 24. The fact is, for most crackheads and heroin addicts and meth addicts and alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, means I don't understand, they've lost the power of choice in drink and drug. My so-called willpower became practically non-existent at that traffic light. I was unable at that certain time to bring into my consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering of last night and the humiliation of the past 3 days. Even a week or a month ago, I'm without defense against the first thought of crack cocaine. Huh. How do I protect myself from those certain times? I can't. That's why I must have conscious contact. That's what it means to not have a choice, to be mentally powerless. You guys get that?
Yeah.
Okay.
I do.
So that we just covered the physical and the mental powerlessness. That's how I take people through the book. Now, I don't take everyone through the steps the same way. I don't. Y'all call it booking up here. I don't book everybody the same way. I pray about it. I trust my intuition. Some guys go line by line. Some guys only get a few paragraphs here and there. I've got guys come to me that know the book better than I do. I don't even use the book with them. As soon as I don't use the book with them, I can see their ego has just been shocked back. They're like, "What do you mean you're not going to use the book?" If you live the way of life described in this big book to the best of your the best you can do with what capacity you have, you will become the big book. My late grand sponsor was a guy named Dom P, and he said, "Do you think you can take someone through the steps without using the big book?" And the guy he was talking to said, "Well, no, that's impossible. It's heresy. I'm a big book guy. I have to use the big book." And he said, "Listen, pal, if you live the way of life described in the big book long enough, you will become the big book, and you won't need the big book to take someone through the steps." Okay. You want to knock us out?
Yeah, so basically what are we talking about? We're talking about the first half of the first step. And the first half of the first step is divided into two parts. It's divided into the mental, and it's divided into the physical. That's the language of the heart. I don't care if you're alcoholic. I don't care if you're addict. I don't care if you're a sex addict. I don't care if you're a gambler. When you take one of something, do you lose control over the amount you take after you take one? That's why it's been a blessing for me to work with anybody, whatever you do. Because the book breaks it down very simply. And all you have to do is send them to the first 23 pages and ask them to take statements and opinions, turn them into questions, and ask them, answer them themselves to see if they've lost the power of choice. I don't care what it is. So for me, it doesn't matter what you use. It's about, have you lost power of choice in your body when you take something? The identification is not necessary. If you've lost power of choice, you probably have the allergy. I don't answer it for them. I let them answer it. And then 23 to 43, the mental obsession. When you get some distance between that and which you love the effect produced by, does a thought come and tell you it's a very lovely day? It's 180 degrees outside. That's quite insane, right? And it'd be a very nice day to have a beer. And you've got some distance between you and alcohol, and you buy that lie. That it's a nice day to have a cold beer. Or you leave work, and you ain't used in God knows when, and the thought comes, I'm just going to do a tenner. What do y'all call it up here?
A beer.
Huh?
A dime.
A dime piece. I'm just going to do a dime piece. And you buy that lie that you can buy a dime piece. Now, you ain't been able to do a dime piece in God knows when. But you buy that lie that you can do a dime piece. What happened for 20-something years don't even come into your consciousness. You find your way, on your way to the dope man, to buy a dime piece. If that's true for you, you buy the dime piece, you do the dime piece, and before you leave, you only leave because they kick your ass out. You don't spend every cent you got. That's the obsession. You're a believer of the lie. So it's been very important for me just to base that piece, first half of the first step, on a physical allergy and a mental obsession. And whatever it is that you do, if you have that, you're probably in the club in the club. Don't matter what you do. Do you have the power to stop? Do you have the power to control the amount that you take? Can you go to the bar, sit down and have a shot, get up and go home? Real alcoholic can't do that. Real crackhead can't go to the crack house and smoke a dime and leave. A real heroin addict can't take a shot of dope and have a wake up. Any heroin addicts in there? Yeah. Can't take a shot of dope and have a wake up, and the wake up not burn a hole in your pocket, right? That's the allergy. That's the allergy. I know when I wake up in the morning I'm gonna be sick. I'm as high as I can get, right? I just got some good dope, right? But the dope starts calling me out my pocket. My fix me up. I gotta have, you gotta fix me up. I can't stay here.
What about the other voice?
And
you're gonna be sick in the morning.
Yeah, but the other voice outweighs that voice. I don't care about being sick in the morning. I shoot that wake up. That's the allergy with a heroin addict. And you're right. A lot of people don't understand that until a heroin addict sits across the table from another heroin addict. They don't understand the allergy with a heroin addict because heroin is physically addicting anyway. So that's been the criteria. Touch on the fact. Powerless over alcohol. Oh, touch on the fact that you're still powerless over alcohol, meaning if I'm at it, I can't drink. Why? Because my history shows me, and might not be you, but you might want to pay attention, that whenever I start drinking, it's only a matter of time before I shoot dope. How you know that, Mike? Because I tried it so many times. I'd get out of the joint, I'd hook up with my brothers who only drank, smoke reefer, sniff cocaine. We'd sit at my oldest brother's house on a Friday night, and we'd play cards, whist, poker, spades, and we drinking, and we smoking, and we sitting there, and we drinking, and we smoking, and somewhere around 1 o'clock, Heron says, you know it's time to go, right? you know you don't want no more of that shit, right? Why? Because that does not give me the effect that I like. No, not that I like, that I love. There's something that I've had a love affair with. If you're like me, one thing. And like I said, for the sake of tea, some people, there's two. But for the majority of people, there's only one. I had the most important, unconditional, loving, cherishing, demanding relationship I ever had in my life, and I've been married twice, and I'm engaged now. The only relationship I ever had that got me to do whatever it wanted me to do was heroin. No holds barred. I'd know I was going to the penitentiary. Spirit would speak and say, don't go in that store. You've been in that store 3 times this week. They waiting for your ass. And guess what? Heron said, no, they ain't. You got to get me. Go in there and get it. No holds barred. So that's allowed me, and I'm talking about my own personal experience, to solidify my foundation. That's why I don't do AA. I am not alcoholic. Does that mean I can drink? No. I can't drink. But I can't identify with a real alcoholic. I can't identify with them old timers, man, that they drank no matter what. Then some youngsters that come in there, man. They love alcohol. I don't love alcohol. Dollar to a donut, if you're in the fellowship, there's something that you had a love affair with. Some of y'all.
Mm-hmm.
And some of y'all just had a rough Saturday night. And, you know, you had the power to come see us, and you came to see us, and you like our coffee, and you like our women, and you like our men, and you like to come to retreats and stuff, and so you hang out with us. But then there's somebody here, man, that your life depends on what we do in the nucleus of recovery. That if you don't get it, and you walk out that door, it ain't guaranteed you coming back. You don't think like that, though. I didn't think like that. I didn't think like my brother. My brother got that bag of dope on that Friday afternoon when he went uptown. Didn't have no habit. He just went to hang out. He just wanted to speedball a little bit. Mix a little cocaine, a little heroin. And then go back to Brooklyn to his family. He had a family, 5 kids and a wife. He had habits, but he was able to do something with it and break it. But he just went uptown to hang out that Friday afternoon. He didn't know he was going to die. I know he didn't know he was going to die.
He just was going to do what he had done a number of times. We don't think like that. So being here with us this weekend, God has graced somebody in this room. He's graced you one more time. He's given you a daily reprieve. Somebody said it earlier. He's given you a daily reprieve one more time.
Can I interject real quick?
Mm-hmm. You don't have to whisper. You can. Go ahead.
So I want to read something I stumbled across that I just find very interesting. There's a distinction between acute addicts and chronic addicts. Acute alcoholic and chronic, or maybe acute problem drinkers. So acute problem drinkers and recreational drug users have a serious problem. But when they see the destructiveness of their drinking or using and make up their minds to quit, they do, and they stay clean and sober on their own. They don't need to constantly help others. They don't need to work all 12 steps. They don't need to go to meetings. They don't need to join a home group. They don't need to listen to fifth steps. They don't need to make all their amends. They don't need the sponsor. Even though from time to time they may indulge in some of these activities if it's convenient. These actions are optional and not a matter of life and death. On the other hand, there is the chronic problem drinker or drug user who, no matter what is at stake, no matter how sincere the desire, they eventually suffer from their abstinence to the point where it becomes unbearable, begins to tighten in their spread in their chest like a spring that demands relief. In a desperate move, they will return to drugs and alcohol time and time again until it eventually kills them, or they're locked up or take their own life. These are the people who programs such as AA and CA and HA were designed for. If you can stay clean and sober without it, that is a good thing. But please don't hold it over those that will die without it. The people that welcomed you with love and open arms into a fellowship you didn't need. Who knew? They're all welcome.
Yeah. Everybody's welcome. Everybody's welcome. We got three types here. We got the one that can just take it or leave it alone. Dollar to a donut. We got one of y'all in here tonight. You here somewhere. Then we got the hard drinker or the hard user. Sufficient reason you came to see us. Doctor, judge, wife, husband, kids, job. You came to see us. And you stayed. You had the power to stop. You ain't worked a step since you've been here, though. You ain't getting no sponsor because you don't want him telling you what to do, or you don't want her telling you what to do. You don't want nobody directing your life. Thank God I had directors and teachers. Thank God Joe said to me, man, do this or die. And I became willing to do it. And then you got this guy here, man, that this is the last house on the block for you. And you've been playing with us for years. You've been taking your life for granted for years. You've been in and out for years. In and out. In and out. But here's an explanation for you. Most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. Page 30 in your big book. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. It says someday, the idea that somehow, someday, I will control and enjoy my drinking or my using is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The phenomenon of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. That's my brother. Death. He pursued it to death. That he could control it and enjoy it. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholic or addict. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people or presently may be has to be smashed. What's step one? Step one is a smashing process. Step one wipes out all ideas that you can do anything about what's going on with you. That's why they dedicate four chapters to step one. They want you to get an in-depth, thorough knowledge of your condition. And they break it down section by section. Physical, title page 23, mental, 23 to 43. But then they bring you up on they bring you up on the hook. The unmanageability, second half of the first step. Why is it you got time under your belt and you've been sitting around in meetings for eons? You're still restless, you're irritable, discontent, full of fear, insecure, prey to misery and depression. Having trouble with personal relationships, can't control your emotional nature, the four horsemen come along and wipe you out, terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. You've been here for eons and everybody's life you touch turns to mush. You can't keep no constructive, healthy relationships. Why is that? Because something's missing. The spirit of a living God is missing. The healing process hasn't totally taken hold in your life. It's the root of what I suffer from. It's what got me here long before I took my first anything. It began to plague me before I took that first hoof out of that paper bag with that airplane glue. Growing up on that block in that ghetto with a big square head wearing thick bifocal glasses, who in elementary school was getting all A's, and I wasn't the norm on the block, I was abnormal. My grandmother used to call him the hoodlum and the gangster, and I wasn't like them. I was different, so I got picked on. Had fights every other day, or ran home from school. And I began to need to find a way to live. Because I was uncomfortable in my spirit. I was restless. I was irritable. I was discontent. I was full of fear. I was unhappy. I was the youngest of five brothers, and they were all gone. Raised by three women, no father. My spirit was twisted. I watched TV and had shows like Father Knows Best and Leave It to Beaver. They had all had mothers and fathers. Y'all with me? My insides. I had to find something to help me to live in concrete and pavement. And I found that airplane glue. I'm not quite sure, and I'm going to say this. I don't know if I found the airplane glue first or masturbation. I'm saying it. Because somebody in here, you just like me. I'm quite transparent with my life. After I put me out there is what you do with it. I'm just telling you truth and honesty. I don't know which one it was, but it was something to help me live in my skin. Because I was dying. And it worked. And it continued to work for a while. And I kept adding stuff on top of it. Adding stuff on top of it because nothing fully sufficed until I met Heron. Heron fully sufficed. I said it earlier, I'll say it again. Heron is magical. You don't believe me? Try it. It's magical. But I just got to a place where I wasn't willing to hang out no more. The consequences as a result of hanging out with it was not worth it anymore. I finally woke up one day and saw you dying, Mike. And it wasn't physically. I was dying physically, but on the inside, I was a shell of a person. And I didn't like it. And like T said earlier, being powerless was unacceptable. The other piece, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. I heard those messages in that recovery program, that treatment program. Two different deals, treatment and recovery. I heard there's a way out. Then I heard a gentleman that carried a message. The book talks about a message with depth and weight that caught my attention and heard my attention. You know the one thing that I heard that he said? You don't ever have to shoot dope again. I heard it. My life hasn't been the same since. So the crux of step one is based in spiritual malady, mental obsession, physical allergy. If those are true for you, you're probably in our club, whether you want to be or not. And it might behoove you to get aligned with what we do, because your life could be on the line next time you make a decision. So I think it's time for a break.
Yeah. Yep.
You're giving us the...
Yeah, that's it for tonight for us.
All right.
We're going to shut it down. We'll see y'all in the morning.
All right.